The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
All right, in our structure of things, under section C on tongues, where our discussion has been focused very definitely from an angle, and that is the revelatory character of the tongue, we have seen that first of all in terms of origin, then in terms of content, and now in the third place, some further observations, where we'll try to, I guess when someone gives a designation like that, it shows that he really doesn't have it all together in the best way yet, but trying to touch on a couple of questions that come up inevitably from what we're saying and we haven't looked at explicitly. There are three of these sets of observations. A. Concerning the nature of the language phenomenon, this has been one of the most discussed questions about tongues. That is the phenomenon described in Acts the same as, or is it different than that found in Corinth, in Paul? And are the tongues seen as a whole in the New Testament, existing foreign language? Foreign languages, or an unknown, perhaps heavenly language, or are both involved? I would say that from our discussion so far, we have to exclude some type of linguistically unstructured, preconceptual vocalization. Whether or not that is to be referred to as ecstatic or not. I don't want to get hung up on that term here, but I think some type of linguistically unstructured, preconceptual vocalization is excluded now for the reasons that we have already noted, particularly the interpretability of the tongue, as we understood that interpretability. But now, existing foreign languages or some other kind of language, same in Acts, Paul, or different? I think a fully adequate treatment of this set of questions requires more time than we can give to it here. Especially since, at least as I look at things, these questions are not as basic as they are usually held to be. What I'll do here is simply make several comments that are, so to speak, to be weighed in the balance overall, whatever else is to be put on the balance. And comments, again, that point us, let's put it that way, comments that point us to the conclusion that the phenomenon in Corinth and Acts are the same. That is, existing foreign languages in Corinth as well as Acts. That statement, of course, is made on the assumption that they are existing foreign languages in Acts, which some would question, but I think few, if any, very few doubt today. I think then these are considerations which ought to put us in the position of at least feeling the need to hold open the possibility, put it that way, hold open the possibility that the phenomenon in Corinth is the same as in Acts, that is, foreign languages. And two more specific observations along that line. So far as 1 Corinthians 14 is concerned, so far as I can see, nothing in 1 Corinthians 14 excludes that the Corinthian phenomena is known existing languages. That's a kind of negative way of putting, but I think a fair way of putting it. Nothing excludes that the Corinthian phenomena is known existing languages. That is, nothing demands that what was present in Corinth are some new unknown heavenly languages. A second observation that bears on my statement that I think we ought to be prepared to hold open the possibility that the phenomena are the same. This is looking now in Acts and calling attention to the fact that in Acts we have the same pairing, the same definite association of prophecy in tongues that we have observed in 1 Corinthians 14. The same pairing or a connecting of prophecy in tongues in Acts as in Corinthians correspondence, which then I think is fairly taken as pointing us to the fact that they are the same phenomenon, at least a presumption for that. In Acts 19:6, the sum of what took place there in the experience of these Ephesian disciples, Acts 19:6, the sum is that they were speaking in tongues and prophesying. Elalun te glosais kai eprophetuon. And I would take then that 10:46 is making essentially the same kind of generalization when, with reference to what took place among the Gentiles, the household of Cornelius, the statement is that they were speaking in tongues and magnifying God. Speaking in tongues and magnifying God. Assumption here, of course, is that the tongues phenomenon in chapters 10 and 19 is the same as it is in chapter 2. And that would seem to be a right assumption, looking at 10:45 and 11:15 and 16. 10:45, 11:15 and 16. So there is this same kind of pairing in Acts that we have in Corinth, prophecy in tongues, to be weighed for whatever it's worth. Secondly, this picks up a bit and seeks to drive home a little bit more a point that we've been making all along. Not only do these verses, Acts 19:6 and 10:46, closely associate prophecy in tongues, we may say further that in chapter 2, tongues are seen as prophecy. Tongues are seen as prophecy. I think we must say that unless we are going to say that the tongues at Pentecost are completely outside the scope of the fulfillment of the Joel prophecy, which I don't think anyone would want to do. If, to put it positively, if the tongues at Pentecost fall within the scope of the fulfillment of the Joel prophecy, then I think we must say that tongues are in effect prophecy, particularly looking at Acts 2:17, as well as the summary statement in verse 11, proclaiming the great things of God, which I would take as a prophetic indicator. Acts 2:17 and 18, particularly at the end of 18. And these observations on Acts 2, Pentecost, tie in then with what we have already been pointing out in 1 Corinthians 14, confirms the observation as to the functional equivalence of prophecy and interpreted tongues. The functional equivalence of prophecy and interpreted tongues. And puts us, in the position where we can make this generalization in the importance of being able to reach this generalization will become clear tomorrow. The generalization is that New Testament tongues are properly viewed as a form of prophecy. Tongues are a mode of prophecy if the latter is taken, that is, prophecy is taken in a slightly expanded but essentially unchanged sense. New Testament tongues, a form of prophecy. And thirdly here, on these observations, further observations, a somewhat more lengthy discussion on the matter of the private or devotional use of tongues, on the private and devotional concerning the remarks that bear on the private or devotional use of tongues. In 1 Corinthians 14, Paul is primarily concerned with the use of tongues in the public assemblies of the church. However, at the same time, the passage does contain indications that appear to point towards some kind of private exercise of the gift. Particularly verses 18 and 19, where Paul reflects on his experience, verses 18 and 19. I think the point is less clear in other verses pointed to for this private exercise, verses 4 and 28. This is all in 1 Corinthians 14, of course. Verses 18 and 19, less clearly in 4 and 28. The cutting edge of my discussion, however, now, is that if we take these indications of a private use of the gift seriously, these indications hardly support the developed, and in some instances at least, consuming preoccupation with a private or devotional use of tongues, as that private use is sometimes advocated largely by appeal to this passage. And let me go on then to develop matters this way, that such private uses as may be within Paul's outlook, his purview in the passage, whatever private uses he may have in view are certainly to be controlled by the following considerations. So I guess now we have considerations within consideration. And there are, two points I want to make here. Matters that would bear on a private use of the gift. First, any private use of tongues is not a gift somehow separable from, in addition to, or independent of its public exercise together with interpretation. Any private use of tongues is not a gift somehow detachable, independent of its public exercise, as that public exercise is always to be with interpretation. As the situation we're saying then is not as if a private gifts on the principle of distribution, private tongues are for some, public tongues with interpretation are for others. Rather, it seems to me we only represent Paul fairly, correctly, if we say that any private use is strictly ancillary. Any private use of the gift is an accompanying or subsidiary benefit that is enjoyed by the recipient of the gift which is to be interpreted when exercised in public. Any private use is an accompanying benefit enjoyed by the recipient of the gift as that gift is to be interpreted and as that gift involves a distinctive revelatory function. And in this connection, let me call attention to the fact that it is just the prayer tongue and the song tongue that Paul refers to in verses 14 and 15. It is just the prayer tongue and the song tongue that stands under the repetition by Paul of the command for interpretation. Verse 13. And that's a repetition of the command in verse 5. It's just that command that he repeats before he goes on then to pick up on these particular forms of tongues expression. Now, with reference to this question of the private use of tongues and the matter of self-edification, as Paul expresses it in verse 4 in connection with tongues, this self-edifying function of tongues. And I am not as some inclined to take that expression, he edifies himself ironically or tongue-in-cheek or whatever. I think we ought to take it at face value. I think a most instructive parallel at this point we're bringing up, most instructive parallel is from the experience of Paul himself as he touches on that, and I underline touches on it because that's the way he feels about it, dealing with it, discussing it, 2 Corinthians 12, 1 and following. Passage in 2 Corinthians 12, 1 and following. Now, before we comment rather quickly on these verses and raise a number of questions which I probably won't lay to rest or deal with here. Just have to leave our discussion time for that. But as we begin, or before we comment on this section, particularly at 12:1 and following, be sure that we recognize, note the context here, chapters 10 through 13, the larger unit, is the context of Paul's defense of his apostolic office and his gospel. Now, I'm not so much putting emphasis here on apostolic as on office and gospel ministry. Defense of his office, his public function in the church, gospel. And in this context, where he's called to defend himself, he touches on, refers to the sublime and inexpressible experiences which he has had. These enrapturing experiences mentioned in verses 2 through 4. And they are experiences which he says he would prefer not to boast about. Verses 1, 5, and 6. Now the point that I have especially in mind in bringing out here is that these experiences of the apostle, these experiences are not an end in themselves, but they are an accompanying, and somewhat subordinate feature of the visions and revelations which have been given to him. And he refers to those in verses 1 and 7, visions and revelations. That's what I mean when I say these experiences are not an end in themselves, but they are an accompanying feature of the visions and revelations which he has been given. Revelations, then, we must stress, which lie at the basis of his gospel, as it is to be preached, that lie at the basis of his gospel, the gospel preached to the whole church. The best background that we, I think, can supply in the New Testament for commenting on this passage is the passage in Galatians 1, 11 through 17, where Paul, again, you see, in a similar situation, is defending his apostleship, and again reminding ourselves of this context, 10 through 13, what the main concern of the apostle is. Now, these experiences of the apostle, they had, to be sure, an intensely personal character. They were precious to him, and they are not to be slighted or depreciated in terms of what they meant for him as an experience. But these experiences do not fall within some private sector of personal religion. These experiences do not fall within some private sector of religious experience in distinction from his apostolic ministry. Rather, to say it once again, looking at the context, these experiences are an attendant aspect of that ministry. Secondly, bearing on the matter of private use of tongues, the principle of differential distribution that applies to tongues also includes any private use of the gift. The principle of distribution, differential distribution, variously distributed gifts of the Spirit, includes any private use of the gift. So that I think we have to say that the notion that the public use of tongues with interpretation is only given to some in the church, while their private use without interpretation is for all. I'm saying the notion that the public use of tongues with interpretation is only given to some in the church, while their private use is for all in the church, that is a construction that puts a strain on the statements of the apostle beyond what they can bear. We have so-called all statements in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 5. I wish that you all spoke in tongues. Verse 18. I speak in tongues more than all, more than you all. Verse 23. Verse 23. If all speak in tongues. So far as these all statements are concerned, they are surely to be interpreted in the light of the negative answer required by Paul's rhetorical question in 12:30. Do all speak in tongues? And the no that requires, or as the question could be put, all do not speak in tongues, do they? And the answer to that question, the negative answer to that question, no, all do not speak in tongues, we should stress here again, that negative answer does not trace back to some negative factor, to some debilitating factor, such as lack of faith, or failure to seek the gift. But rather the no of 1 Corinthians 12:30 is rooted in the edifying reality of differential distribution. The edifying reality which takes shape as the harmony among the diversity of gifts and functions variously distributed among the many members of the one body. I spoke of, three here. I should have said four. Just very briefly, touching on another point. It is sometimes maintained that the gift of tongues involves the decisive transformation of the life of the believer. That the gift of tongues involves the renewal of Christian living. As it is characteristically put, the gift of tongues brings to its recipients a deeper devotion to Christ, greater fervency and freedom in prayer, a more intense desire to witness. Now, my point here is not to make judgment of other believers' experiences, to categorize it or qualify it in every respect. That's another question which I hope that we may be able to touch on. But my point here is this, that surely the overall thrust of 1 Corinthians 12 through 14, and especially chapter 13, the overall thrust of the passage is precisely in an opposite direction, and particularly with reference to tongues. Paul's point, his basic point, can be boiled down to this, that such qualities, devotion to Christ, fervency in prayer, freedom in witness, such qualities which are to characterize every believer are not dependent or bound up with receiving a particular gift. And his point is that particularly they are not bound up with receiving the particular gift of tongues. That brings us then, with your indulgence, and hopefully not decimated wrists, in the overall development to section 5. Section 5. Section 4, we have been concerned with prophecy in tongues as to their nature. Beginning now, our last major section, section 5, we want to address ourselves to prophecy in tongues, the question of cessation. The question of cessation. Now, it is widely held today that the New Testament does not teach the cessation prior to the parousia of all the gifts mentioned in Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 12, Ephesians 4. Or to put it positively, widely held today that the New Testament teaches that these gifts do continue until the parousia. And further, this outlook maintains, in one way or the other, that the view that certain gifts have ceased is a matter of a posteriori rationalization, after the fact rationalizing on the part of a church embarrassed by the absence of these gifts in its midst. There are, however, in my judgment, several lines of New Testament teaching that in their convergence point to the conclusion that prophecy in tongues were intended to cease prior to the parousia and have, in fact, ceased. And these are the lines now that I want to try to set out here. Some necessarily more briefly than others. I hope not too briefly. And there is a sequence of, at the point there are seven. We'll begin it here with one. The first consideration bears on the temporary character of the apostolate. The temporary character of the apostolate. Now, on this point especially, which in a sense is most basic, I'm going to have to be brief and recall on my discussion that I've had, I think, at least with the large majority of you, in discussing the question of canon in the course on New Testament introduction. And we'll just have to proceed that way. Can't go over all that ground again. Hope that won't leave others too much in uncertainty about what I'm saying. We have to leave to the side here now a discussion of the varied usage of apostle in the New Testament, focus our attention on what, for the sake of discussion here, we can refer to as apostle in the strong and in highest sense, what we could refer to as the apostles of Christ. And our point here is to emphasize that they and their activity, the existence of the apostolate in the church, is confined to roughly the first generation of the church's history. This temporary character can be seen along several lines, and I'll just indicate them here very quickly. There is, first of all, bearing on the temporary character of the apostolate, there is, first of all, the requirement that the apostle be an eye and ear witness of the resurrected Christ. The apostle as eye and ear witness of the resurrected Christ. Acts 1:8, just some examples. 22:4-33, John 15:27. Secondly, there is the indication that Paul gives that he is the last of the apostles. Paul, the last of the apostles. Look particularly at 1 Corinthians 15:8-9. And compare 4:9. Further, there is the fact that Paul does not designate as an apostle, Paul does not designate as an apostle Timothy, who more than anyone else can be viewed as his personal successor. Our sum, then, is that apostolic succession, that expression, apostolic succession, in a personal sense at least, is a contradiction in terms. Apostolic succession, a contradiction in terms. It's a matter of the once-for-allness of the apostolate. Or that delightful German term, the Einmaligkeit of the apostolate. Now, this, if we recognize the temporary character of the apostolate, that brings with it the further recognition, particularly when we consider the situation in the pastorals, the church situation in the pastoral epistles. Recognition of the temporary character of the apostolate brings with it the further recognition that the distinction between apostolic and post-apostolic is not one that is imposed on the New Testament, but that is given by the New Testament itself. The distinction between apostolic and post-apostolic, so far as the church's history is concerned, is given by the New Testament itself. And this recognition, in turn, carries the further demand, particularly when we remind ourselves of the obvious and central importance of the apostolate, we must recognize the demand to determine what elements of church life described in the New Testament, what elements of church life are so integrally associated with the ministry of the apostles that they disappear with the passing away of the apostles. And on the other side, what elements continue on into the post-apostolic period of the church, the post-apostolic present of the church? We are beginning with the temporary character of the apostolate, recognition of that. We have been brought to insist that there is need to determine, at least to raise the question, maybe that would be a fair way of stating it here, raise the question, which elements of the church life described in the New Testament, which elements are so integrally associated with the ministry of the apostles that they disappear with the passing away of the apostles, and which elements continue on beyond the time of the apostles. That is a question coming on the agenda given by the New Testament itself. Second, the apostles are very active and variously active. But we can say that the single most important activity of the apostles is that already touched on of witness. Witness to Christ. Martyria. And look at the scriptures just there cited under point one. Witnessed to the person and work of Christ as the consummation of the history of redemption, as that history is consummated in his death and particularly his resurrection. Now, with reference to this apostolic task of witness, I think it's fair to observe that Ephesians 2:19 and following. Ephesians 2:19 and following is the New Testament passage that provides perhaps the most comprehensive perspective on this task. Looking at Ephesians 2:19 now as the passage that overviews in the most sweeping, comprehensive fashion the witness task of the apostles. Now again, this is a passage that I've worked through with most of you, and so again, we'll have to economize on our discussion. What this passage does, Ephesians 2:19 through and following, it views the New Testament church in terms of the model of house building. It views the New Testament church as the result of that great house building activity. The New Testament church as the result of the house building activity of God in the period between the resurrection, the exaltation of Christ on the one hand, his return on the other. The church as the house God is building in the period between the resurrection and the return of Christ. And you can see that same essential model being used by Peter, 1 Peter 2, 4 through 8. Now, as Paul views the church in this way, he then calls the apostles, along with Christ as cornerstone, the foundation of the church. The foundation of the church, verse 20. Now, when Paul calls the apostles, along with Christ, the foundation of the church, this is not said in order to shade the finality of the person and work of Christ. He's not shading what he has said elsewhere, for instance, 1 Corinthians 3:11. that Christ is the only foundation. Christ, the only foundation. He is not shading the or qualifying the finality of Christ's redemptive work, but he is including the activity of the apostles now with reference to the work of Christ. He's including the activity of the apostles in a specific respect. And that respect aspect is witness. The apostles supplement the work of Christ not by additional redemptive accomplishments of their own. The apostles supplement the work of Christ, rather, by bearing witness to the work of Christ. They bear witness to the work of Christ. So we may make this observation to try to capture the impact in this respect of Ephesians 2:20. To the once for all foundational work of Christ, which has reached its consummation in his death and resurrection, to the once for all foundational work of Christ is joined the once for all foundational witness of the apostles to that work. To the once-for-all foundational work of Christ is joined the once-for-all foundational witness, interpretation, explication of the apostles to that work. And we should emphasize at this point that the foundation that Paul is talking about in Ephesians 2:20. The foundation is historical in character. The foundation is historical in character. It's part of a redemptive historical picture or image. He's not talking here, for instance, about where the gospel goes for the first time, where the church is established in some local situation initially. But he's talking rather much more comprehensively, viewing the one church of Christ as a whole in the period between the resurrection and the return. When Paul speaks here of the foundation, he is speaking about that which is done once at the beginning of the church's history and does not need to be repeated. What happens once at the beginning of the church's history and does not need to be repeated? And as I said to you before, the period beyond this foundational period is not a matter of perpetually relaying foundations, but in terms of the house model, the period beyond the foundational period is the period of the superstructure, that which is being built upon the once laid foundation. Let me just add this here before we call a halt. It's in terms of this foundational witness that we can appreciate the emphasis in the New Testament on tradition, paradosis. In view of this apostolic foundational witness, foundational witness in which the apostles we're noticing now are involved, that we can appreciate the emphasis in the New Testament on tradition. The tradition to be held fast to. 2 Thessalonians 2:15 and 3:6. The emphasis on the deposit. Similar term. The par Theke in 1 Timothy 6:20, 2 Timothy 1:14. Should all be in your canon notes, but there you've got it again. This emphasis then on tradition, we can say, this emphasis points the way to the eventual emergence of the New Testament canon. And in the New Testament, the indication that we have in 2 Peter 3:16. So there are these considerations that we have wanted to set out, and we'll pick up, move on to take a third step as we begin tomorrow. First, the temporary character of the apostolate and the function of the apostolate as witness. Now,